From the studios of Farm Journal Broadcast, this is U.S. Farm Report.
Welcome to U.S. Farm Report. This weekend, I'm Tyne Morgan. We're taking a break from the road, back in the studio for just this weekend. And here's what's in store over the next 60 minutes.
House Republicans will humbly look in our hearts and elect Mike Johnson as Speaker of the People's House.
Chaos in Washington settles with the new Speaker of the House. That's as ag economists still cast doubt on timing of a new farm bill.
I did not see this coming. I was completely blown away.
Cotton harvest wasn't the finish this Texas farmer expected. We're kicking off our 2023 cotton harvest tour. At 22 years old, her curiosity sparked a career that's taken a life of its own.
Oh, it's definitely still risky. I have like weeks that I'm like, what am I even doing?
A road trip to North Dakota to meet social media sensation, Ag with Emma. And in John's world,
a crop in the field.
U.S. Farm Report, presented by Pioneer. What's next happens when blood, sweat, and tears meet rain, wind, and sun. Pioneer, what's next happens here.
Now for the news. After 3 weeks of gridlock, there's now a new House Speaker. Republican Congressman Mike Johnson of Louisiana was given the gavel on Wednesday. Johnson picking up an important nod of support from former President Donald Trump. He was the fourth candidate Republicans nominated to replace Kevin McCarthy. Johnson was quickly sworn into office, announcing Republicans would restore the people's faith in the House. But even with the new Speaker in place, pessimism is growing that Congress will pass a farm bill next year, let alone in 2023. According to the latest Ag Economists Monthly Monitor, which is conducted by Mizzou and Farm Journal, the majority of ag economists think we will see Congress pass a farm bill extension either by the end of this year or by January 31st. However, getting a new farm bill through Congress is a different story. More than 50% of ag economists surveyed think it'll be 2025 before we see a new farm bill.
I think that's what economists are reacting to, is the political realities of entering a presidential election cycle. And the ag economy is generally healthy. So a lot of these changes that you might typically see in a farm bill year, maybe some of them can wait with an extension of the existing provisions and budget allocations.
Economists say the biggest hurdle in getting the farm bill passed in 2024 is the fact that it's an election year. The economists also say they're concerned about overall legislative dysfunction and farm bill funding issues. One economist says there's just no urgency in Washington to get a farm bill passed right now. Harvest has now leaped past the halfway point when it comes to corn, and well beyond that for soybeans. USDA reporting 59% of the corn crop has been harvested, up 14% from last week and 5 points ahead of the five-year average. When it comes to soybeans, 76% of the crop is harvested. That's also up 14% from last week and way ahead of average. With growers racing against the weather in Illinois and the Dakotas, harvesting 18% of the crop in those states in just this past week.
The I-80 Harvest Tour on U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by Case IH. The Farm Hall has been an iconic partner on the farm for generations. Come celebrate a century of Farm Hall, the one for all, with us at farmhall100.com. And by AGI. At AGI, we spend a lot of time focused on product details, making sure you can store your grain how you need to and move it when you need to. Learn more at aggrowth.com.
Harvest is well ahead of normal in Iowa, with 62% of the corn out of the field as of Sunday. It's well ahead of the 47% for the five-year average. Soybean harvest stands at 83% complete, which is 16 points ahead of normal. Yields in Iowa are variable from border to border and even field to field due to spotty rains and drought, which covered over 90% of the state since late May. Larry Jacobson's farm in central Iowa only ran 6 to 8 inches below normal for moisture, but he says the early season flash drought shaved yield potential as well as late season heat stress.
There's going to be areas that have been hit hard. I mean, there's still drought. We've got a what they consider our area, a light drought, and there's still areas that are extreme drought. So it just depends on where you're at and kind of how the weather affected you.
He says his corn yields are running below 2022 at 220 to 230 bushels per acre. With the heat, that is impacting test weights. Those are light at 57 to 58 pounds. Soybean harvest is done at Jacobson's farm, and he says yields ranged from 60 to 65 bushels per acre, also down from a year ago. Well, slowing down harvest this week, the first winter storm system of the season. Pacific Northwest and Northern Plains covering some areas in a foot of snow or more. At Timberline Lodge at Mount Hood, Oregon, heavy snow fell Tuesday night before leveling out a bit on Wednesday. The snow also moving into Montana and North Dakota. After the storm pushed through, temperatures took a nosedive with chilly air anticipated for the Northern Plains. And those lower temperatures could dip as far south as Texas early next week. The U.S. Farm Report weather team will have more on that coming up. The U.S. is on track to achieve a record-breaking year in soybean meal exports this season. It's reported an estimated 13.2 million tons shipped in marketing year 2022 and 2023, with a total value of nearly $7 billion. The surge in exports is attributed to increased soybean crush for biomass-based diesel production and expanded shipments to the European Union and Vietnam, as Argentina's soybean meal exports were hampered by drought.
Historically, we've exported, 11, 12 million tons a year, and we've got, record exports from this recently completed year. But in the years to come, we're going to have increased production and availability of soy meal.
A new check on the fertilizer industry says that the market is recovering. The report from Rabobank analysts say while global fertilizer use dropped by 7% last year, they expect an increase in usage by 3% this year and by 5% next year. As for prices, they're forecasting a positive outlook through 2024. They say the nitrogen market faces challenges due to lower demand from corn and wheat growers, while the outlook for potash and phosphate is positive. The potash market right now has ample supply, while the phosphate market is on the rise thanks to the return of Chinese exports. Farmland prices in Iowa appear to be leveling off after 2 years of record highs. The Des Moines Register reports several factors are contributing to a slowdown, including drought, declining farm profits, and rising costs along with higher interest rates. But despite those things, farmland prices in the state inched up 0.6% last month compared to last year. Last year, farmland values in Iowa surged by 10.4%, averaging more than $13,700 an acre. And that's after a more than 43% increase in 2021. That's it for the news. A big temperature swing this week. We'll have your forecast coming up next.
U.S. Farm Report weather is brought to you by H&S Manufacturing. Poly sides, floor, and a rear monoblock gearbox on vertical beater models are just some of the great features of the H&S Hydra Push 425 and 550 bushel model manure spreaders. Find out more about the Hydra Push at the H&S website.
Time now for a check of weather with meteorologist Matt Engelbrecht. Matt, talk about a sudden shift this week after such a mild stretch with this Indian summer. We saw a blast of cold air enter the picture this week. How big of an area do those below normal temperatures now span?
Yeah, thanks, Tyne. In terms of just how far we're expecting this cold air to reach, well, I got a map here in the United States. Nearly two-thirds of it expected to be at or below normal regarding our highs and our lows. And the pocket of coldest air continuing to sink into the Midwest and then back down here to Texas, into Texas and Louisiana, mainly because that's compared to average. Now, the timestamp is going to be very important on this because there's two things that you'll see on this map. This is October 31st, so Halloween into November 4th. That's only going to be 4 or 5 days with these below normal temps. We're starting to see hints, as you'll see in a second with the jet stream. The second part of this map is right here. If this was cold, we'd be talking about an extended period of cold air in and across the United States. But with that trough trying to dig down to the south, that cold air trying to dig down to the south, the ridge that is building on the west coast will be nudging that out as we get into next weekend. So by Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we're going to see a shift back to average, if not slightly above average temperatures. And you'll see that with the jet stream here in just a second. October 31st, Halloween through November 4th, you got a ridge of high pressure, as well as that cold, dry air digging in across the United States. So not expecting much in the way of rainfall. Most of the rain that came down regarding these two systems, the trough and the ridge, and most of that rain came down earlier in the weekend. So Thursday, Friday, and Saturday is when that rain really picked up. So as we go through our Sunday and Monday, you'll see that trough right up here in the top part of your screen. Because this ridge is stronger than expected, that cold air, it is going to be expansive, but it's not going to linger in and across the United States. So this is going to be moving through Wednesday into Thursday, and you start to see that hint, which I was just talking about, the ridge building, warmer air building off the West Coast, that is eventually going to translate to the east and pick up these white lines, literally pick them up and push them to the north, which is where we get back almost into a pattern where we're going to see at or above average high temperatures. This jet stream on Friday, very indicative of a warmer than average trend coming to the United States. This is going to pivot out to the northeast with that ridge starting to build back in. Again, that's that jet stream coming up on Friday.
Thanks, Matt. Well, we've seen some talk about grain prices repeating 2008 or other years, but is there a story in these grain markets at all? Joe Vaklovic and Peter Meyer join us with that answer next.
U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by Tendovo Soybean Herbicide, raising the pre-emergence bar one clean row at a time.
Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report this weekend. Back in the studio, we have Joe Vaklovic as well as Pete Meyer joining us for our marketing roundtables this weekend. All right, Joe, we've seen some discussion this week. Is there a story brewing? Are we seeing 2008 repeat itself, 2003 with these commodity markets? But is there a story at all right now?
The 2008 story, I don't see at all. I mean, we had a phenomenal GDP print out this week. Unemployment's super low. People want to be doomers and boomers and recessionists, but I just don't know that there is much evidence to support that. I get that there's inflation. I get that there are some underlying economic issues, but I don't see that story. The story that I see is kind of a lack of a story. Like, where is the catalyst for a bull run in these markets? I know that's what everybody wants to see. We want to see higher corn prices, want to see higher soybean prices, higher wheat prices. I don't see the catalyst for that sort of thing right now. What do we need? Maybe you need South American weather. Maybe you need the river to improve and generate some demand. I don't know what it is, but we need a catalyst. We don't have it.
Pete, Joe's saying there's no story. You agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Joe had to say. I mean, our prices are so high now based on the fact that the Mississippi River is so low. What is it, minus 11 feet in Memphis, something like that. So, you know, and the other thing that I completed about a 3,000-mile trip out to Iowa and back last week. And, you know, the dreaded, better-than-expected yield, especially in corn, rears its head once again. So I would suggest that Joe made the reference to 2018, 2008. I mean, in 18, a lot of people are making that story as well, where we had, you know, yields were down 2 in October and then down 2 in November. I would tend to doubt that's going to happen this year. I think the yields are kind of static. I mean, maybe we go up to 174 or something like that. But the fact of the matter is, when you look at 18, we had about 450 million bushels in extra export demand than we do now. And that's a big part of what Joe was just talking about.
So Joe, Pete mentioned harvest a little bit. We're starting to see now this cooler, wetter weather pattern come in. Harvest had pretty much been uneventful. I mean, it'd been going smooth in places, but are there spots that are having trouble getting the crop out this year?
Michigan is the problem area. That's what I'm told. It's been wet, and people in those areas are absolutely going to be held up for a while. Generally speaking, I don't think that that's an issue that's going to move the market. We could slow down harvest a little bit. It's not a big deal. As a matter of fact, it would be friendly in regard to price action if it results in some river improvement, which is what the Army Corps is projecting this week at least.
Have you been impressed with some of these areas that did see little rain and the pretty decent crop that they are having this year?
As far as corn is concerned, I am beyond impressed. Beyond impressed. I mean, I met with a few guys in Central Illinois who got two rains this summer and are still pulling 250 out. Okay, in corn. Okay, they're down 10 or 15 from last year. Eastern Iowa, I mean, I've spoken to some farmers there that have readily admitted that they've never misestimated a crop as big as they did this year. It is remarkable what the corn yields have turned out to be with so little rain. So to reiterate my opinion on that side, I am beyond impressed with the corn. On the beans, it's a 49.5 crop. I mean, there's nothing too exciting about that, but the corn was unbelievable.
Joe, are you the same? Is that the story this year, just how impressive this corn crop is with all the weather challenges we saw?
I think it was the story. I don't think it's the story anymore. As you move forward, the story is going to be South American weather, demand, 2024 acreage, the economy, things along those lines. I think that generally speaking, we trade row crop yields in June, July, and August. It's almost the end of October. We're past that story, barring the USDA making some kind of out of the ordinary type change here, I think.
Well, demand as well as 2024 acreage, those are the things that we need to talk about. But we need to take a quick break first, and then we'll have much more right here on U.S. Farm Report.
Some states saw harvests at a rapid pace while it's dragging on for others. And for those, it may seem a bit like Groundhog Day. Here's John Phipps.
I've never really been into country music, but the Kenny Rogers hit Lucille always tugged at my heart when it got to the line, with four hungry children and a crop in the field. Look, I feel for the kids, of course, but I have stayed awake too many nights over the last 50 years obsessed with getting a crop out of the field in the fall. Machinery breakdowns seem to be waiting for the worst possible moment. A mild forecast of showers seems like code for a downpour, and problems at the elevator promise a nightmare out of my control. This year was a bizarre combination. After record warm weather all around us and just enough rains, we had pretty good yields, specifically corn that didn't want to dry down. To be fair, we are blessed with a large modern grain facility less than 6 miles away, but even their massive drying capacity has been clogged with just a little too wet corn. And of course, if the corn is borderline for Cargill's bins, putting it in our own is like setting a time bomb. Mother Nature just needs to retrieve her 2% of moisture. So that now that I have been promoted to the logistics team, my childish patience has been challenged by 90-minute turnarounds and a harvesting rate less than half of normal. Sitting in the line, I can imagine this crawl to completion could last all the way into December. But after a shower that kept me out of the truck today and bought a little room for the elevator to have some breathing room, my tour of competitors around me offered me a tiny bit of optimism. Many of them will be done in a week or so, and their semis won't be hogging the lines at the elevator. Good riddance. I mean, congratulations, guys. I'm not sure why this year has been such a downer for me, but reliving the 1990 harvest of mud, the Halloween 4-inch rains that turned an enjoyable harvest into a death battle, and the stories of my father of the year of the southern corn blight have been painfully refreshed. My son does not share those experiences mercifully, and I struggle not to relate them. He will have his own dark memories to haunt him. How fitting it is that Halloween falls during harvest. Maybe we are decorating the holiday of horror with the wrong stuff. After all, a 12-foot skeleton is not a terror match for a broken grain cart axle.
Thanks, John. Well, a classic Case 430. We're on the road for Tractor Tales next.
Hey folks, welcome back to Tractor Tales. This week we are heading to Illinois to check out a retired Case 430.
So the Case has been on the farm since it was brand new. It's never left. And it's a construction king. As you can see, it's painted the construction yellow with the orange frame. The regular Case row crops were desert sand and the frame was a red color. And then this is being construction king, the front end is real heavy duty, built real heavy duty, because that's where the loader mounts on. And we still have the loader, we just don't have it done yet. And it looks so nice, I almost hate to put the loader back on it. Raised a lot of hogs and cattle here at one time, and it was the main loader tractor, and just has never failed us. I mean, it's just been here ever since it was brand new. I want to say it's about a 65 or 66. It was my landlord at the time, he lived here at one time, he bought it brand new, and it just kind of left it here when he retired. In the wintertime, you had to have weight on the back and chains on it because you couldn't get around. They were light in the rear end, you know, but the loader on them was what sold them. It was very fast and powerful. The decals on there, I could not find them, could not buy them. We had to have them custom made. And it sat in the corner of the shed, and the best thing I ever did was I shut the gas off. Probably sat there for 15 years. And I got it out. I said, I'm going to see if I can get it running. Put gas in it, turned the gas on, popped right off. And my son said, you can't get rid of that. This has been here since forever, and it's going to stay here.
When we come back, parts of the South and the Southwest sweltered in record heat this summer. But in one pocket of Texas, cotton yields were a major surprise. We'll show you where as we head to the land of cotton next.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. Trusted, timely, tradition. The Cotton Harvest Tour on U.S. Farm Report is brought to you by Delta Pine. Dedicated to cotton, committed to you.
We've been covering corn and soybean harvest in the heart of the Midwest this year for our I-80 Harvest Tour, but this year we decided it was also time to head south and check out a different crop, cotton. According to USDA, 40% of Texas's cotton crop is currently harvested, 1 point ahead of average and 1 point behind last year. Harvest may just be getting started in West Texas, but in the southern part of the state, it's already wrapped up. And this year's harvest came as a major surprise. With every pass,
I did not see this coming. I was completely blown away.
And every turn. Harvest was a bit of a surprise for this Texas farmer.
Cotton is an amazing plant to grow, and it hides a lot of its secrets until you finally get the leaves off of it, and then you go, oh, wow, I didn't see this coming.
Matt Kutzenberger farms just outside of College Station, and this 700-acre field is planted right on the edge of the Brazos River.
Well, actually, we had ideal planting conditions, which was kind of a shock. And then as soon as we planted this, it turned off very cool, and we had quite a substantial amount of rain.
That rain even drowning out parts of this field right after planting, with sparse plants and spots, signs of the aftermath.
After Mother Nature turned off the water spigot, it went extremely hot.
It wasn't just a week or two of heat, but relentless record heat all summer. College Station set a new record of 50 straight days of triple-digit temps. The old record, just 30.
We saw daytime normal temperatures that got up to 110 degrees. That doesn't even count the heat index.
More than the heat during the day, Kutzenberger says the thing that hindered the crop more this year was the warm nights, as temps stayed in the mid to upper 80s.
Even in the mornings when you'd walk out, it's like opening an oven. It's just that heat, just kind of the wind and the heat just hits you. So a lot of this cotton never had a chance to just, you know, I would say relax at night like everybody else gets to do when they go home. So that was one of our main struggles as well this year.
This area also saw no rain during that time, and Kutzenberger says that made keeping the crop irrigated a major hurdle.
Irrigation is what I like to call a rainfall supplement, not a rainfall substitution. And this year it was a rainfall substitution, and it's very hard to try to keep up when Mother Nature doesn't give you a little bit of a help.
Ask any Texas farmer and they'll tell you 2023 was definitely a struggle growing cotton. But that's also what makes these passes with the cotton picker even sweeter.
I was amazed. This the field that we're sitting in here was definitely 3-bale-plus cotton, and it was actually a shock to me.
On the edges of the field, yields were even higher. As Kutzenberger got to the final rows, the cotton plants were laying over from all the weight of the plant packed with bolls.
As we were running through the fields picking this and in that corner, there were some amazing yields by the instant yield monitor. I saw 4-bale. I saw spots that went 4.5, you know, just in the instant yield monitor.
He admits he was pessimistic even a few weeks before harvest, but after they defoliated the crop, that's when this field revealed the truth.
And so whenever you get to strip it down and get all the leaves off of it and you get to start harvesting it and you get to see this, I was just blown away. I was blown away.
With rain in the forecast the week he was harvesting this field, three machines created a rapid rhythm, with Kutzenberger not wanting to risk giving up any potential quality with the cotton crop.
I wanted to get all of this cotton out prior to any rainfall whatsoever getting on it, because that initially or inevitably will hurt your grades and it won't pick as clean as it has been.
The ultimate report card comes from the gin, and Kutzenberger says the grade and quality of this crop was good.
You get to reap the benefits of what you sow. And so being able to come out here and get in the cotton picker and harvest a crop like this Had you asked me a month ago, what our cotton crop was going to be like, I would have told you I'd rather not talk about it.
After a choppy start and challenging growing season, it's the quality, along with surprising yields, creating a sweet ending to what could have been a very bitter year. Well, we also have plans to go to Georgia, Tennessee, and West Texas to check out cotton harvest there this year. Well, when we come back, is there a demand story and what could acreage be for 2024? Yeah, we're already talking about it. That's our marketing roundtables next. Welcome back to U.S. Farm Report. This weekend, Joe Vaklavic, as well as Peter Meyer, joining us. All right, we talked about how there really wasn't much of a story right now in the grain markets. But what about demand? We are seeing some export sales now on the books. People say, wait, you told me there was no demand. Why are we seeing these export sales? Is there still no demand, Pete?
No, it's seasonal demand, right? This is the time. If we weren't seeing demand now, I'd be very worried about it. But Chinese contingency in Iowa this past week, of course, they signed the documents that are non-binding. We see a few sales here and there. We get some corn sales. It's a seasonal pattern as we go into harvest, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing we have it, because otherwise we'd really be in trouble.
Joe, what's your thoughts on exports right now?
Exports are the problem. We've got some positives out there in terms of domestic processing. There's going to be kind of a secondary biofuel boom the way that it looks. But exports are a big swing item on the corn balance sheet and a big swing item on the soybean balance sheet. And the sales are just not there. You can't ship what you don't sell. And we need to see the pace of sales improve. We've seen some improvement. And I think that in the case of corn, maybe you hit USDA's target. But even if you do that, you're still at a 2.1 carryout at the end of next year. So you're going to need something else, something in addition to the sort of sales that we're seeing right now.
I would also add as well there that, you know, no matter what the exports do for soybeans, you're still at a 200 million bushel carryout, right? Joe was talking about the high side on the corn carryout, which I totally agree with. But on the low side, where's the carryout going? I mean, USDA has told you here for 2 months in a row. The World Board has told you for 2 months in a row they're not going below 220. Maybe we go to 200. So, I mean, that goalpost is static. It's just standing there. And the market's just trying to figure out what it's worth in the U.S. with a 200 million bushel carryout. And a lot of that has to do with what's happening in Brazil and the weather there moving forward.
Yeah, so we are hearing about some weather issues down in Brazil, but enough to put a detour on the expectations for a monster crop in South America, Pete?
It's a little bit early for that, in my opinion. I mean, we have to see how it turns out here. I mean, it is an El Nino year, so we'll see what happens. I mean, I would think that Argentina probably has a risk of not rebounding to 55 or wherever the World Board has them at the moment. But again, as to Joe's point earlier, with a 2+ billion bushel carryout, it's going to have to move. We're going to have to see some demand show up here pretty quickly, regardless of what happens in South America.
Yeah. And at this point, have those weather issues in South America, have they moved the markets much, Joe?
No, not at all. And to go back to the soybean carryout, it almost feels to me like the market doesn't believe it. I mean, we've got like record carries in some of the calendar spreads, yet we're being told the carryout's 200, 220, whatever. I don't know. I think the trade is very much on board with the idea that Brazil is going to produce a monster and that Argentina is going to rebound. And if they're wrong, then that's where you get your soybean rally. The soybean balance sheet that the U.S. is, it's tight. I mean, it's tight, but the global balance sheet is a different situation.
So what potential do you think we have for U.S. acres next year?
Well, to Joe's point, the soybean balance sheet is tight this year. It's going to be tight next year. It'll probably be tight the year after that. And, you know, it's really just a matter of where the USDA sets their pipeline number. As I said earlier, I think that's probably around 200. Certainly, when you look at the economics of corn versus soybeans at the moment, we would expect that you're going to see more corn acres again next year, because it makes perfect sense. And I do understand from some boots on the ground, not necessarily people that I'm talking to, but I'm getting it secondhand, that there have been acres changed just within the last week or so, with these 24 corn still above $5 and November 24 soybeans well below 13.
Joe, you think Pete's right on par with that?
Yeah, 100% agree. The farm budgets that I've seen for next year indicate that corn is still a winner economically, and that's not for every farm in the country, but generally speaking across the Midwest, that's going to be the case. My personal feeling is that the markets messed up last year. They bought too many corn acres for 23, and it looks like they're in the process of doing the same thing in 24.
All right, Joe, Pete, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. We need to take a quick break, and then we're off to North Dakota, our Women of Ag feature. We meet Emma next.
Tynes Women of Ag is brought to you by John Deere, who celebrates the strength and resilience of the women who make farms run.
Curiosity is the wick in the candle of learning. And for Ag with Emma, her curiosity has produced lessons and a field of opportunity. Her social media accounts have garnered quite the following. And as we show you this weekend, the secret to it all may just be hard work. That's this weekend's Women of Ag.
From glimpses of harvest to a peek at producing crops in the northern plains.
I'm Emma, I'm a farmhand in North Dakota, and I'm going to take you on another crop tour.
This 22-year-old's journey in ag is truly unique.
There's not a lot of people in my situation that can openly like travel to go network with people and see their farm and showcase what their family has built on generations, and I just think it's a really cool opportunity to be able to show that.
There wasn't a blueprint or playbook to follow. Instead, Ag with Emma was born out of a curiosity to share what she knew.
I started sharing ag facts every day on my story, like, oh, there's only 10 GMOs, or cows have four different stomach compartments. And then I decided I wanted to make that more of a public story, so I created a different account.
She says her grandparents then started asking questions about what she did at work, and that sparked another idea.
Anyone can share an ag fact on the internet, you know, but when you start personalizing those facts and your story, then that's what really makes a difference with your audience and other people that want to learn about the industry.
Today, Ag with Emma's YouTube account has 170,000 subscribers, some of her videos racking up more than 32 million views.
I never liked being in front of a camera, and I still kind of get shy about it, but since I use my phone, it's like it's kind of more natural. So that's how I started. I just wanted to share facts, and I started sharing facts, and then I just started sharing my story.
But taking risks and going the unconventional route has become Emma's MO.
So I kind of grew up in agriculture. It's not a typical family farm background. I did have various experiences.
Not growing up on a farm, Emma went to a community college in southern Idaho to get her associate's degree. After that, she took the logical next step and enrolled at a university.
But once I got into the university stuff, I decided that because I was a transfer student, it's always a little harder as a transfer student, I personally think, because you get to this new university with a bunch of big classes and you don't feel as connected.
She felt trapped. So just a month into her second semester, she decided to drop out.
There's so many people out here and so many people willing to take a chance on you and like help you learn that you shouldn't have to sit in a desk in school to pay for things you don't like.
She left school and started working on a farm in southern Idaho, and then started working with a custom harvesting crew.
My parents thought I was crazy. Like, my parents always supported me, but they can still think you're crazy. I've always been the academically goal-based kid with like a 4.0. I had a bunch of scholarships, so when I dropped out, everyone was like, Emma, what are you doing?
But that risk has turned into so many more opportunities, more than even Emma imagined.
It's just fun and it's cool and I love to work hard, so when I'm home at the end of the day and I'm exhausted, I love it. And it's just, you get to learn new things all the time because you never stop learning.
And with that, the 2022 season comes to an end.
And in that first year, Emma's journey was packed full with too many lessons and memories to even count.
There's just something about agriculture that you just, I feel like you learn so much about yourself and about life in general that you just feel way more connected to your job.
Since leaving college in 2022, Emma's worked on about 7 different farming operations, but she's also sprinkled other jobs throughout, sharing a slice of life from each farm.
There's some farmers that are comfortable with it, like that's part of the reason that I work here. And then there's other farms that I work on that might not let me share it all, which is completely fine.
Emma's already met so many different farmers and dabbled in agriculture in many different ways. She currently works on a farm in North Dakota, and this fall marks her first time harvesting sunflowers.
I didn't even know you harvested sunflowers, Popeyes. But now I know, and I've been helping, you know, get them ready for sunflower harvest, and it's all just, you know, you learn as you go. And
it's not just U.S. farms that Emma is exploring and sharing.
I think I couldn't have done that any better. Well, I could have, but pretty spot on.
Last winter, she even took a trip to Australia.
So I went down there right after custom harvest was done, and then I went and harvested down there. It kind of taught me about different things that farmers have to face in different areas.
Emma still has big dreams, and her journey around the globe is just getting started.
So I definitely want to go see some farms down in like Brazil or South Africa, even some up in Canada. Like, I haven't been to Canada yet.
Emma wants to operate equipment on all seven continents, but her ultimate goal is much bigger than that.
Eventually, I want to get into owning something or maybe doing some of my own. Like, I don't know, maybe I'll do custom work in the future. Maybe I'll own farm ground. Maybe I'll start trucking. You know, it's just that's the part of the ag with Emma that I don't limit down because, you know, it goes with the risk.
With each stop and each farm, she's constantly in motion, sharing it all. Even if she knows this career comes with what she calls calculated risks.
Oh, it's definitely still risky. I have like weeks that I'm like, what am I even doing? And then I think that I have to go do something else. So every time I go to find a new adventure, it's a risk because you never know what's gonna happen. You never know what you're gonna learn. And it just, you know, you have to calculate that risk and keep moving forward.
Thanks again to Emma for allowing us to come visit in North Dakota. She really was such a joy to work with. And if you have an outstanding woman of ag you think we should feature, let us know. You can email us at mailbag@usfarmreport.com. When we come back, the true carbon footprint of ethanol. Could it be up for debate? Customer support is next.
Carbon dioxide is carbon dioxide.
Well, the company Navigator withdrawing its petition in Iowa to build a carbon capture pipeline. ADM says it's staying the course, and pipeline opponents are now suing to block the Summit Carbon's water permit. There was a lot of news on the carbon pipeline front this week, but viewers also have questions. That's customer support.
Pipeline opponent Dan Tronchetti questions different kinds of emissions. The IRFA research paper that claimed we needed CO2 pipelines to save the ethanol industry was a flawed piece of work. Were you aware there are two kinds of CO2, biogenic and anthropogenic? The EPA does not track biogenic CO2 because it is part of the natural carbon cycle and is considered carbon neutral. Anthropogenic CO2 is produced when fossil fuels are burned, such as coal, to generate electricity. Fermentation at an ethanol plant produces biogenic CO2. Capturing the biogenic CO2 will not lower the carbon intensity score of an ethanol plant. The only way to lower the carbon intensity score of an ethanol plant is for them to reduce their anthropogenic CO2. Carbon footprints are defined as, for a product, its carbon footprint includes the emissions for the entire life cycle, from the production along the supply chain to its final consumption and disposal. That's from Wikipedia, and it pretty much matches other sources closely. There are not different kinds of CO2. There are different sources. Biogenic CO2 is mostly fermentation emissions, which are theoretically matched by carbon consumed by photosynthesis of the corn plant and balance out. But consider this basic example. An ethanol plant releases both anthropogenic and biogenic CO2, indeed twice as much biogenic, but CO2 is CO2. If you reduce either one, you reduce the footprint or total emissions. CCS, carbon capture and storage, reduce emissions of CO2 regardless of where it comes from. It turns out fermentation emissions are not just larger, but are also easier to capture. So even if biogenic CO2 is already matched by plant recapture, reducing them reduces the ethanol footprint. The Renewable Fuels Association, the head cheerleader for ethanol, shows this reduction in admittedly fine print on the life cycle analysis. Capturing fermentation CO2 reduces the footprint 25 to 30 grams per megajoule. It is an important selling point for the RFA when comparing to fossil fuel footprints. Since plants can't magically identify or consume only biogenic molecules, if CCS is used on fermentation emissions, equal anthropogenic CO2 will then be absorbed by the plants instead.
Thanks, John. When we come back, this isn't your average grilled cheese. It's the world's largest. So how did two Wisconsin brothers, at only 10 and 11 years old, accomplish that cheesy, massive feat? That answer's next. £300 of dough and £60 of cheese. That's what it took for two Wisconsin brothers to cook up a grilled cheese fit for the Guinness Book of World Records. And the massive feat, well, it happened by two brothers who are only 11 and 10 years old. This is Exodus and Iggy Chowdhury. They're from Wisconsin. According to DairyHerd.com, the two have been on a mission on their YouTube page to break the world record for the world's largest grilled cheese. They used a custom welding pan, and it took nearly 1 month to assemble. Get this, once it was all complete, it was a whopping 6.25 feet wide, 10.9 feet long, and 2.75 inches thick. It was actually more than a foot longer than the previous record, but it took a month to make. I don't even think they could eat it when they were done. All right, that's all the time we have this morning. Thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to watch us next weekend. We're on the road. University of Minnesota is our next stop for College Roadshow, and we hope you tune in as we work to build on our tradition. Have a great weekend, everyone.
U.S. Farm Report is produced and distributed by Farm Journal Broadcast.